David Murata joins us, the president of Murata Wealth Management, online at muratahonmoney.com. Today's topic is a continuation of a series we've been doing, looking backward on socialism, fulfilled by different countries today. So some remarkable things. And David, thank you so much for the series. It has really gotten a lot of interest from people in the listening audience who are fascinated by this topic and want to know more.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I've been kind of thinking about doing this series for about 5 years, and I finally have gotten around to kind of putting it all together.
So we got to go back to the book, because not everyone's been listening to all of them, and we're talking about Edward Bellamy's book. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so Edward Bellamy published a book in 1888 called Looking Backward, 2000 to 1887. And in the book, someone goes into a trance state and wakes up over 100 years later in the year 2000, and the United States is a socialist utopia. And his book described a national socialism, and his vision really changed the course of history. It's probably the most influential book that no one's ever heard of, and so it's kind of an odd patient zero for a lot of different ideas that came out of it. Looking Backward found a massive audience from its publication in 1888, you know, clear through the 1920s. And many readers or listeners might think, you know, I've been focusing on a book that was written in 1888, and that's a quaint historical sort of sideshow, but and they say, you know, I've never heard of it. What does it matter today? Why waste your time refuting its ideas? But the short answer is that really ideas matter, and Bellamy's ideas are on the rise again. A person's worldview really changes the course of their life, and a society's worldview really changes the course of history. One of the most common political questions that I get asked is, what's wrong with socialism today? Mm-hmm. And there's little more important than answering that question decisively. So hence my interest in this one book that really has had an influence all over the world and still has an influence in the news today.
You know, it is remarkable how detached we are from history. And I want to start out by talking about the United States. And David has done a lot of research on this, and we're going to get it posted up online so that you can look at it and make reference of it sometime soon. But so we were talking about Edward Bellamy, the author of this book, and yet that didn't stop right there. The family had another person, a cousin, who was instrumental in part of our history.
Yeah, Edward Bellamy's cousin his name was Francis Bellamy, and he was an American Christian socialist minister. He's best known for writing the original version of the U.S. Pledge of Allegiance. Both Bellamy's were national socialists, and they were really sort of advocating a national socialism. And the original version of the Pledge of Allegiance was, I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands, one nation indivisible with liberty and justice for all. And they purposefully wrote the Pledge of Allegiance to not mention the United States. Mm. That was added later. They purposely wrote it to not mention God. That was added later. And so this version was intended to be able to be said by all of the national socialist countries of the world, really pledging allegiance to the idea of a collectivist loyalty rather than an individual loyalty, a collectivist valuation rather than an individual liberty valuation. The pledge was designed to be part of a flag raising ceremony. And it was designed by Francis Bellamy, and he writes very specifically about what to do during the ceremony. And and one thing to do is to my flag. At that moment, you're supposed to extend your hand toward the flag in what later became known as the Nazi salute.
Wow.
So for from the 1889 until very very late in World War II. Mm. The national pledge to the American flag was done with a Nazi salute. That later was written up in a couple of movies in 1909, and it was called the Roman salute, and it was picked up by Mussolini and as the national socialism salute of Italy. And that then Mussolini was good friends with Hitler, and Hitler was his protege, and that was picked up by the National Socialists and Hitler. And in fact, even during World War II, it was an embarrassment that the Nazi salute is what every school child was did in the public school flag raising ceremony. And they also had corporal punishment for kids who wouldn't do the salute. And there were a lot of religious objectors who said, I'm not going to pledge my allegiance to the Republic. My allegiance belongs to God. That went all the way up to a Supreme Court case, and the Liberty lost, and the Supreme Court said, yes, they can institute corporal punishment for children who won't do the salute to the flag and participate. That was later, after words, that was later reversed by the Supreme Court, but it was much, much later that it was reversed. And it was well into World War II that Congress finally, in an embarrassment of children doing the Nazi salute, finally changed it to the heart over the flat, heart over, hand over the heart salute that we sort of came to know today. At any rate, this is just sort of one small little piece where the Bellamy cousins changed the course of America and really sort of had an entire decades of school children in mindlessly chanting this pledge toward the Republic.
Well, there was a time when Congress added the words "under God." I'm imagining that was at least some attempt to salvage the situation. I mean, did people realize this history at the time?
I actually don't think it was that much of an embarrassment, except for the Nazi salute and mm-hmm. the fact it didn't say "under God" and the United States was added, and that sort of, I don't know, sanitized the entire intent of a National Socialist chant. But the educators of the day thought it was very important to have school children very early on in their career giving a pledge toward the collective rather than a pledge toward individualism, because they thought that immigrants to the United States weren't going to sort of cohese around the idea of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so they needed these pledges to bring those immigrants into line with being committed to the United States.
We've got just under a minute. Was there ever any alternate proposals or any other sort of thing that they talked about along the same lines, or was this really just come up and on its own?
This was really just Francis Bellamy's idea, and mm-hmm. and he thought it would be a great idea. You could say they were trying to sell flags, but I'm not mm-hmm. even sure that was the primary motivation. I think yeah. the primary motivation was simply to try to have this collective socialism and this National Socialism be trained by every school child in a not a re-education, but a first education, so that they would be primed for a more collectivist experience.
The Schilling Show continues with David Murata. We're looking back on socialism and the fulfillment and implementation in different countries. We'll come back on the other side. We talked about the United States. We'll go to France, Italy, Nazi Germany, Russia, China, England, if we have time. And of course, we welcome you here, 434-977-1070. If you have comments, questions, or challenges for our guest, David Murata, we welcome you. Samantha stands by. There's a line open right now at 977-1070. And The Schilling Show will return right after news and weather.
I can't deny. Don't you hear me talking, baby? Love me now, I'll go crazy.
And a pale complexion and a fear of race. Now they got me in a straitjacket and I can't move.
Hey, so the song is Trouble in the Country, and I love when it comes up because we got so much trouble in the country. We're talking about socialism today and the various fulfillment over the years of this book by Edward Bellamy. And it's coincidental but very much related to what we're talking about, David, as I'm looking at the headlines right now. That riot police are storming Hong Kong, and they're waving an American flag and singing the national anthem there. They know that America is the beacon of freedom, even as we're under attack internally and externally in this matter, that people still look to this country as something to emulate.
Yes, indeed. And from Edward Bellamy back in the 1888, it's a two-step hop to Mao Zedong and Communist China. So it's really interesting that we help bring about Communist China from our one little book in the United States.
Let's go to France, and we'll talk about George Soros. And this is not George Soros, in case people were getting confused here. But tell us about.
Yeah, Georges Soros was a French philosopher, and his work inspired many socialists, anarchists, Marxists, and fascists. Soros read Bellamy's Looking Backward in 1906. He wrote his own sort of expansion upon Bellamy's work. It wasn't a contradiction, and it wasn't I agree with it 100%. But his response was called Reflections on Violence. And he thought Looking Backward was a little too utopian in the style of which he, you know, it was postulated that the United States socialist utopia would come about. And he said there's two things that move people to action, and these two things are important to add to Bellamy's work. He said one of them is this idea of myth, and he thought that myth was more important than truth. So the idea that there's a mythology that you state, it does not matter if the mythology is true or not. What really matters is that it moves people to action.
Like Obamacare is going to save you money, that sort of thing?
Yes, or like the Third Reich is a continuation of the First and Second Reich, or that this Roman background is what fascist Italy is an extension of. Italy was a relatively young country, but they created this mythology of them being a continuation of this Roman times and power and honor. And so the idea is that the myth is more important than the truth. And the second is that violence moves people. So actually, you know, the black shirts, you know, are actually the right way to move things. And you can do that, they thought, through the idea of what we would call labor unions. They would call them syndicates. That's the French word. And syndicatism is the French philosophy that comes on George Sorrell. And in terms of inspiring things, they helped inspire the Italian futurists, which was a whole group during the early 1900s. And lots of people wrote responses to Edward Bellamy because that was interesting. And, you know, in one work, you know, humanity reaches Mars, specifically Italy reaches Mars and establishes socialism on Mars. So there's all these sort of science fiction stories in the spirit of Edward Bellamy that were published in the early 1900s in Italy. And then Mussolini has been quoted as saying, you know, I owe most to George Sorrell because his entire philosophy is what inspired Mussolini's entire movement. And that was definitely a national socialist movement. It was not, you know, people say that the fascists and the Nazis are somehow right wing.
Well, that's a popular talking point.
It is, and it's simply not true. If the idea of right wing is free markets and individual sort of liberties and things like that, the Nazism and socialism and fascism are the opposite of that. So it requires a little bit more of a spectrum on of different things. And in terms of individual liberties and economic liberties, fascists and Nazis and socialists all line up. If there might be a small distinction in that a lot of socialists are not as war on the war-peace spectrum, and socialists are slightly less on the war side, not entirely. And you can see that in some of the true socialist countries. They're still willing to go to war, but the national socialists are just more willing to go to war. It's really their only distinction. True socialists only reserve their violence for internally against their own people.
Wonderful.
But you know, but that, I think that's a small distinction. But on the good-bad scale, it's slightly more good to only crack down on Hong Kong rather than taking the whole world into war.
I've got to ask you how they get away with this mischaracterization of fascism in particular, but they use the word Nazi a lot too in conjunction with conservatism and constitutionalism, because it's such a lie, and yet it's perpetuated constantly.
Yeah, the popular media portrays fascist Italy and Nazi Germany as demonic cults of pure evil. And by such characterization, they're really unhelpful in understanding politics and political movement. You know, you really, the minute you've called someone a fascist or a Nazi, it's really just an ad hominem attack. It's you're a bad person. And it really shouldn't. We should actually really look at fascism and socialism and the movements that were inspired by it. You know, as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. and we're really coming back to a rhyme of a national socialism that I think is very dangerous in this country. And it's like the people who are supporting it are just not students of history. Oh, yeah, yeah, I know. So, you know, in history, it's turned out badly in many, many, many instances. But they weren't true socialists, mm-hmm. because true socialists would have turned out to be a utopia.
Yes.
And there's even a popular article in terms of Snopes.com. And Snopes on the political spectrum ends up being, unfortunately, I think, very liberal. And Snopes.com, you know, asks the question, you know, were Italy and Germany actual socialism? Mm-hmm. And the writer of that particular article says, well, they couldn't have been socialism because they turned out badly.
That's
wow, that's his argument for why
myth.
They're not socialism.
Wow.
Is because socialists believe in a utopia in which everyone is treated equally, and they didn't treat everyone equally, and they ultimately, you know, seized power and had all these other bad things happen. You know, but we covered in our very first radio show that socialism always ends in violence, mm-hmm. because how do you bring about a utopia where everybody believes in the state? You have to suppress and force people to accept that, and that automatically results in no socialism can be brought about except by means of which socialists disagree.
That's a very interesting concept, and people ought to think about that.
Yeah, so it has its own seeds of destruction. So to say that Nazi Germany and fascist Italy resulted in violence to their own people and violence to the world, to conservatives or libertarians, that's a tautology. It's got to end that way. It's got to end in a poor implementation. So for Snopes.com to say they weren't socialists when they already admit in that article that they called themselves socialists, mm-hmm. and they had many socialist tendencies is really unfair. And then they turn around and say, are they right wing? And they somehow say, yeah, they were right wing because of A, B, and C, when in fact no right wing person who believes in free markets would ever have believed in a nationalized economy with lots of different regulations on business that were totally controlling every mm-hmm. business aspect and telling them what to do.
I want to step back before we go to this next break to France, because you would think that France had learned through the French Revolution that violence was not a good answer, and they certainly suffered enough of that. So for them to be, for George Sorel to be justifying violence, did that fall flat, or had people just forgotten their history like we've forgotten ours?
There was a socialist movement in France, but it didn't pick up and seize control the way it did mm-hmm. in Italy and Germany. But it was certainly a socialist movement in France. You know, to think that we learn from history is unfortunately a very naive view if you look at history. Mm-hmm. We tend not to learn enough from history, and we tend to sometimes learn the exact wrong lessons because these same ideas keep coming up again and again about how to nationalize stuff. But you're right, George Sorel was not as popular in his own country mm-hmm. as he ended up being popular in Italy and in Germany, and his ideas were really picked up by them, and the mythology and the violence worked to great advantage in those countries for those who advocated it.
Let's go to the break. We come back on the other side. Our final segment, we're looking at backward on socialism and how it's been fulfilled in different countries. On the other side, we're going to go to Nazi Germany and then beyond to Russia, China, maybe even England if we have time. 977-1070 is the phone number. The Shilling Show, back with David Murata. Got a theme going today. It's socialism, violence, history, and going forward. Talking with David Murata into the final segment here of this hour, looking backward on socialism fulfilled by different countries. So we kind of touched a little bit on Nazi Germany, but it is very important. And there have recently been some movies. I think Dinesh D'Souza really tied a lot of this together very nicely. And the influence of the Democrat Party and some of the things that were going on here on the Nazis and their brand of socialism. I mean, a lot of these things really tie up very nicely together.
Yeah, there were very many people in both Italy and Germany who, during the rise of fascism and not then the Nazi Party, believed that this was the socialist utopia that was going to happen now in their country, mm-hmm. rather than Edward Bellamy's projecting in the United States. And there were many in the United States that were actually looking at these as very positive movements. Even Franklin Delano Roosevelt talks about, well, we should get some of those ideas from that that gentleman in Italy,
meaning Mussolini,
yeah. because he was just so popular and he had such this great mythology and he was making stuff happen and people were loving him and he was just adored. Both in his own country and in the United States, and And so when they started to turn more nationalist in terms of picking wars and things like that, to many it was a great disappointment of you know, how did this wonderful socialism and this wonderful socialist movement, you know, become the cause for an international war? And many in Germany who were supporters of Hitler did so because they thought he was going to bring about Bellamy's national socialism in Germany. And they too were very disappointed when this didn't happen. So the movement from Bellamy gave rise to these leaders who then disappointed their supporters. And I say disappointed their supporters, disappointed some of their supporters, and some of their supporters who thought the addition of violence in terms of implementing it was a very good thing to do, were not disappointed. So it was sort of a direct two-step to both Italy and Germany and the countries. And the reason why we don't hear about Edward Bellamy today is that after World War II, Edward Bellamy was completely linked to the actual countries he brought about. So after Germany and Italy, the idea of National Socialism really died a death, and Bellamy's vision of National Socialism really died a death. And it's taken, you know, the greatest generation in America gradually dying off for it to be able to be supported, the idea of socialism to be able to be supported, because the greatest generation who fought in World War II really did not like socialism, and they did not like what they had to put down in terms of Germany and Italy. And that was given to be what socialism actually meant, is Germany, Italy, the Soviet Union, China. These are the countries that actually implemented Bellamy's vision.
Let's go to Russia quickly, and then if we have time for China, we'll do that as well.
Yeah, Russia was interesting because in Russia, Tolstoy called looking backward exceedingly remarkable, and we actually have his book of looking backward that he heavily marked up. Lenin's future wife read the book. Gorky claimed every student was acquainted with Bellamy's ideas. Tens of thousands of copies were sold before 1917 in the Russian Revolution. It influenced the Soviet Union in a way that that was remarkable. There's a passage in Bellamy's book where in the United States future socialist republic, no one has a kitchen. They all use a common kitchen because that saves money. When the Soviet Union was building housing for all of its workers, it left out all the kitchens, and they had a common kitchen specifically because of Bellamy's work. They found it had great side effects because not only did they have less space for every worker, and they all had to use the common kitchen, but when you sat in a common kitchen, you had to be careful what you said.
At home, it was the opposite. That's where people talk.
Exactly right. Yeah. So it actually helped put down any dissent, because the dissent tended to happen within families. And when families had a common kitchen with lots of other families, then no one said anything important. And the whole idea of family to them was a little bit counter to the collective. Why should you love your own children more than you love anyone else? And why should you do that kind of thing? And why should you raise your own children? We want to raise them in the re-education camps where they have to say the Pledge of Allegiance to our country.
Let's go to China here. And the Book of Great Unity, there was all kinds of weird stuff going on in China, obviously, again, influenced by Bellamy's book.
Yeah, Looking Backward was translated and published in Chinese magazine format. Basically, Looking Backward was translated and published into almost every country from New Zealand to South Africa, to China. It was extremely popular. It influenced a man by the name of Kang Yuwei, and he went on to write the Chinese version, which was called The Book of Great Unity. It was a utopian future world free of political boundaries and democratically ruled by one central government. And his scheme, you know, he sets it up and he makes it very much Chinese. He brings in, this is the continuation of Confucianism and on like that. And it turns out that that was Mao Zedong's favorite book. And he said, this is the book that inspired me to bring about communist China. So in many countries, it ends up being a two-step process from Bellamy. Bellamy writes it, someone else writes the nationalist version for their country, and that's what brings about the national socialist government that's trying to implement those ideas. So Bellamy's influence was first to the idea of other thinkers, and then from there to the idea of political leaders.
Let's go to the phones. We have just a couple minutes left, and say hello to Greg. Greg, you're on with David Murata.
Well, hey, David. I always love what you have to say, and I'm choking. Excuse me. Anyway, what these all these places, Russia, China, Germany, Vietnam, Vietcong, Cambodia, have in common is they had to kill millions of people in order to initiate their utopia. And what scares me is if they try to push this in the United States and really do get in power, what's to happen here? And I'd just like to get off and get your opinion on that.
All right.
Sorry, I was joking.
Not at all, Greg. Thank you for the call.
As I mentioned, I think earlier, I know at least one person who says Edward Bellamy, because of his influence on history, was probably the worst person in history. His one little book changed the course of history in a way that has really caused at least, you know, at least 150 million deaths in various countries. Mm-hmm. And yes, that is our very first talk on socialism. The end of socialism is always violence, because you're going to have to overthrow my free will in order to get me to go along with stupid socialist ideas. And I'm not the most belligerent person. I'm probably more compliant than most. But in the United States, yes, you would have to run over lots and lots of people. A litmus test of any government program is, are you willing to hold a gun to someone's head in order to make them do it? So, you know, if you have earlier in the program, if you have laws on grass being over 18 inches, are you willing to hold a gun to someone's head and threaten to shoot them if they don't cut their grass and make it low? You know, every single government program requires force in order to do it, and it requires more force for some people than others. Some people are willing to do it if you threaten to fine them. Others, you're actually going to have to shoot them.
And, you know, here in Charlottesville, the threat that they made to Paul and to others is, well, if you don't do the work, we're going to do it ourselves, and we'll send you a bill. If you don't pay the bill, we're going to tack it onto your property tax bill. And you know what happens. If you don't pay your property taxes, they will sell your property and confiscate it. And that's where we go.
Yes. And I, as for me, I think there's nothing more important in today's politics than to be talking about socialism and why it's a terrible idea.
David Murata, thank you so much. A great hour.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
He's online at muratahonmoney.com, and we come back on the other side.